Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to welcome you to Lehigh's campus. Our program tonight is sponsored by the Black Students Union, Visiting Lecturers Committee, the Chaplain's Office, and the E.W. Fairchild Fund. This evening, we are honored to have an extraordinary man with us. Notes of a Native Son, Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone, and Go Tell It on the Mountain are but a few of his poignant works. Not even 10, 15 minutes ago, I had the pleasure of having a meal with James Baldwin. He struck me as a very quiet but forceful man. I'll leave the rest to you. I'm very honored to introduce, for your pleasure, Mr. James Baldwin.
Hello, everybody. I don't intend to talk very long. I thought we would have a kind of rap session, by which I mean that I will discuss some of the things that are on my mind, and then hopefully you will turn the tables on me and discuss what is on your mind, and we'll see what happens. I'm bouncing off some of the young people I had tried to have dinner with. I had stage fright, so I didn't really eat, but they were very nice. And one of them, well, they asked many questions, which I will attempt to improvise around. One girl, dark girl, American, asked me a question concerning racism. And we'll get to that in a moment. What she triggered in my mind, since we are in a university, we're in a place in which young people especially are supposed to learn about the universe. What you triggered in my mind was a question of education that may seem like a very simple-minded reaction. But I remembered something someone said to me many, many, many years ago, or I read it, and I don't remember where it comes from. They said, somebody said, what is honored in a country is cultivated there. And if you think, or I thought, about what I must call my country, since I was born here, since my father's 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 fathers paid for it. And you think of what is cultivated in America and what is honored in America, you might lose heart. It made me think that it may not be possible both to be educated and to be a racist. But let me spell out what I mean by that. Racism is a very common term. Let us try to see what it means. It does not mean, there's nothing to do, for example, with whether or not I like you or dislike you, or whether or not you like or dislike me. It has nothing to do with what church I go to or synagogue I go to. It has nothing to do, in effect, with the job I have. What racism means at bottom is that a certain group of people at a certain moment in time and in space have the power to obliterate you, to destroy you and your women and your children because of the way they have defined you. You're called in this country, in the contents we've been discussing, if you are called a nigger, that gives the multitude who think of you that way the right to demolish, demoralize, and destroy you in as many ways as possible. That is what it means. It also means something else, something much harder to define. It means that the person who has defined the other and marked him for death, because that is what racism means, has not so much defined the other as defined himself. I did not have to grow up to be a man before I realized that the people, my white compatriots, the people who think of themselves as white, and we'll get back to that in a moment, who had spent generations describing my father, for example. Now, my father was a man. When we were growing up, he was not a young man. That meant that he was either uncle or boy, or a saint, or an ex-rapist. That is what my father was in the eyes of this republic, and that is all he was. And he was born to be that. This was the will of the republic, because it was the will of God. I didn't have to get to be very old to be bewildered by my inheritance, which was that God had made me, but not in his image. Neither was my mother at all like the people, white people said she resembled in their books, on the stage, and on the screen. Neither was my sister at all like any of those people in William Faulkner or in Carson McCullers, to leave it at that. And neither was my brother, and neither was I at all like that. Thus one began, and every black person, one way or another, has to deal with this in this time and in this place. Thus one began to look at the people who were describing you. It did not take a vast amount of perception to recognize that the people who were describing you were not looking at you. When I was very young, finding myself, for example, in the hands of the cops, and by definition helpless, young and black and male, I didn't listen to what was said. I watched his eyes. I knew what he was saying. I heard it. I knew all that. I watched his eyes because I was in his hands. And I might not escape alive. I had to watch his eyes. And I thought to myself, okay, if I say this, he'll say that. If he says that, I'll do this. And if I do this, he'll do that. And when he does that, I've got him. Because the bottom, the truth about a racist, all racists, are liars and cowards. All without exception. It is a very difficult sentence, on the other hand, to be born in a racist country under the necessity of outwitting your countrymen virtually every hour of every day. But you learn a lot about them. The trouble is, they don't learn anything about you until today. When I was 11, 1935, in Harlem, where I was born, there was the first of, in my lifetime, a series of what we have called race riots. A better word would be mutiny. Race having nothing whatever to do with the ferment in the ghetto. It has to do with human misery. Human misery. Overflowing. In any case, in 1935, on 125th Street, which was then the main artery of Harlem, the five and dime stores, all the places where we spent all our money and where we were not allowed to work. This is in my lifetime, and I'm not 1,000 years old. I'm not describing ancient Greece or Rome, but New York City, not very long ago. I might be describing New York City or Detroit or Boston today. There was a rumor that a dark boy, Mexican or a Spaniard or a black boy, had been caught doing shoplifting and had been murdered. The truth was, he had not been murdered, he'd been stabbed. But Harlem exploded. The first of a series of race riots in my lifetime and in that city. And for the first time, but not for the last, I heard this resounding question as follows. What does the Negro want? The late Adam Clayton Powell, who was the son of old Adam, who was the pastor of Abyssinia Baptist Church, a very important institution in Harlem too. We'll talk about the church a little bit later. He figured out what the Negro wanted, or at least what he could get for us. And he used the race riot of 1935 to force the five and dime stores of 125th Street and the other stores on 125th Street to hire black people for the first time. This in the land of the free, the home of the brave, in the land my fathers, fathers, fathers bought. There was another race riot in 1943. This one came about because black soldiers, not being completely illiterate, nor their mothers, nor their fathers, nor their sweethearts, nor their brothers, wrote home letters from the training camps in the U.S. Army in the Deep South, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, etc., where they had never been before, had no way of understanding how and why their countrymen in the same uniform could so brutalize and menace and murder them. They wrote letters home. Soldier came, black soldier, came through on leave, 125th Street again, Hotel Braddock. And this time it was claimed that the soldier had been murdered. In fact, he had not been murdered, he had been shot. But Harlem only needed a black man in uniform to be touched in any way, whatever, to explode. And it did explode. And then I heard again, what does the Negro want? This time, Mayor LaGuardia, who had been born, I would like to point out to you, an Italian, but had become an American white man, did not even question what the Negro wanted. He decided, a very important moment in our civic history, that Harlem should be put off limits to everyone except black soldiers, thus creating an interesting precedent that whereas until that time in my life, the ghetto had come about more or less haphazardly, now it was being deliberately created by fiat by the city. And this was proven, let us put it that way, in 1948, when the war had long been over, soldiers were coming home, very much like my father had come home in 1919 to be castrated, burned, blinded, and hung in uniform. The city decided, Metropolitan Life Insurance Company decided, to build downtown on 14th Street something called Stuyvesant Town, named for the Dutch governor who bought the island from the Indians for $24, I believe. And black people were not allowed to live in Stuyvesant Town. And that created a certain self-conscious uproar, because after all, we were in uniform and we had saluted the flag and fought for it and died for it. And we also sang, "Oh, Say Can You See?" Therefore, Metropolitan Life built did not allow black people to move in the Stuyvesant Town. But being self-conscious about their democratic ideals, they built another housing project in Harlem called Riverton for black people only, which promptly, of course, became a slum. And then many more were built, increasing the despair of the ghetto and the paralysis of the young and the helplessness of those who are now growing older. I am telling you all these things, my friends, not because I think you do not know them, but I think you must be reminded, and because it is 1984, and you will have an opportunity to challenge me in a moment, but I suggest to you that what makes the situation so grim are not the facts which I've merely sketched, but the fact that nothing has changed. And in this context, it is very difficult to conceive of or to speak of education. There are so many things the Americans do not want to know. They do not want to know, for example, that they were not white before they got here. Very important to bear this in mind. In Greece, they were Greek. In Russia, they were Russian. In Poland, they were Poles. They were Shanghaied out of Liverpool, dragged out of whorehouses in London, sold out of France, driven out of Ireland, etc. Nobody who had property, no one who was happy in England, for example, got on the Mayflower. Nobody. Georgia began as a convict colony, and nobody wanted to go there. The middle passage of a European who crossed that water to become the white American was as vile and as stinking as mine. Everyone lies about it, but that's the truth. I defy anyone alive to prove me wrong. But what happens to a people who lie about their antecedents and create an identity which is totally false is a dangerous and unprecedented and terrifying matter. I at least know that I had no desire to come here. I know that. I know that I was not sitting in some remote African village chewing up my uncles waiting to be civilized. I became black because of the vagaries of the stock exchange. I became black because the country couldn't have been built without my back. I became black because the white people had decided they were civilized with a capital C and could use any means to civilize this heathen. And the principal means of civilization was to turn him into a slave and then into a Christian and tell him But he was born to be a slave forever. That is part of the history of this country. It is partly because no one wishes to face it that we cannot speak of education in this time and place. I will tell you what an education is supposed to do. An education is supposed to enable you to look around you, to look at the world around you, to look at others around you, to look up into that sky which belongs to everybody, and that earth which will claim everybody, and that water which menaces everyone, and all of the achievements of mankind which belong to all mankind. It is supposed to make you dare to ask questions, to take nothing for granted, to know there are no answers, to know what it is to tell a lie. It is supposed to invest you with the power to discover who you are. And everyone was born to live and born to die. We have a very brief moment to make our discoveries. And the principal discovery one makes is the human being cannot live without the human being. We cannot live without each other. If you have decided, for whatever reason, and the reason is always a very simple one, I will tell you what the reason is. It is a matter of the dream of safety. I can tell you categorically that there are no niggers nowhere. Never have been, never will be. I can tell you where the nigger lives, and the only place he, she lives is in the guilty, white, tormented imagination which had to invent a nigger. Nowhere else. This means a rather terrifying thing. It means that the people who have created this myth are unable to deal with each other and are unable to raise their children. It may seem a very mystical matter, but in fact, no one can live, and no one can love, and no one can raise a child without investing in a certain morality. It is true that all men are brothers. And we, in this place, in this time, in this century, should know that better than all the generations which have preceded us. It is a very serious matter to overhaul the morality of the Western world. That vision, which has always been European, Eurocentered, that vision of life as white and black, that vision of life as saved and pagan, that vision of life which really justifies, in the name of God, the slaughter and subjugation for so many generations of so many millions of people. It is very important that one begin to ask oneself, how did we, the human race, arrive at this point? For where we are, where the morality of the Western world has brought us, the most signal achievement of these generations of civilization is that we now have the power to eradicate mankind. That morality would seem to be prepared to destroy the earth before it is willing to share it. The panic in this country, because that is what it is, comes out of a denied, a buried history, comes out of a deliberate ignorance, an unwillingness to know where we came from and how we got to this place. Comes out of a desperate supposition or hope that the danger of others creates a safety for some. Comes out of a total inability to understand the real meaning of the doctrine of manifest destiny, a doctrine which rules in this country until today, that doctrine which said that the more powerful race, the European in this case, had the right, even the duty, to slaughter anything and everything in its path in the name of a higher civilization. That was manifest destiny. And that controls the American foreign policy in the Caribbean until this hour. And who in this country, who have you heard, who dares to speak against it? Who have you heard suggest that this is not only a history of genocide, but now it becomes suicide? Who have you heard suggest that perhaps this legal and economic system was not built to last forever? Perhaps there are multitudes in the world starving and in darkness because this system cannot serve the needs of the universe. This would be true, my friends, even if I did not say so, and it will be true even if you never see me again. Slavery is obsolete. So is the European notion of nations. It is important to bear in mind, or to think about it perhaps for the first time, that that creature described as a heathen, as a savage, that creature, known first as the American Indian, known now rather more accurately as Native American, had a very different concept of the nation. So did the African have a very different concept of the nation. Both the African and the so-called American Indian, both heathen, both pagan, both savages, born without the light, considered nevertheless that they belonged to the nation. That the rights, customs, realities of their ancestors were sacred and were to be handed down. Really believed and acted on the belief that one should honor one's father and one's mother. Because of this, they were put to death. Because the European idea of the nation was very different. We thought we belonged to the nation, but they thought that the nation belonged to them. We thought we took sustenance from whence we came. They thought that it could all be obliterated and tried to obliterate in the new world. The result, my friends, can only weakly be described as chaos. It has resulted in the virtual eradication of the moral life, the moral possibility, the moral choice. It is important that you understand, when I talk about race, or when I talk about education, or when I talk about history, I am really referring to a moment in history which I am convinced we will survive and surmount. But it is very important that the people who think of themselves as white Americans recognize that white is a moral choice. Recognize that historically and actually, no one in this country can prove he's white. No one. I don't know many people mad enough to try it, but it cannot be done. Neither will such a desperate pretense any longer suffice to reconcile the slave, wherever he may be, to his condition. And it may be important to point out that whereas the system may be based on the carrot and the stick, one might look around one and recognize that if you ain't got no carrot, you ain't got no stick. And I know you ain't got no carrot. What am I pleading for? I am pleading for what we once, hopefully or allegedly, said we believed in on these shores. Some of us really did. Maybe some of us really do. But where are you if you do? Do you realize, if I may point this out, what a small proportion of the American people bother to vote at all? And do you realize what it means when people are no longer voting for this or that candidate, or even this or that principle, but against. Do you really think that we belong, that we deserve all to be slaves to the idea of property, to the idea of poverty? Isn't it possible to rethink where we are? If I say to you, for example, and I cannot prove it, but you can prove it, just by looking around you, that there is no labor movement in this country, and I tell you why there isn't, because of the division between black and white, which has been fomented deliberately by people who don't give a shit about either black or white. The man in the deep south who lynches me or my brother is working for the man on the hill. And he doesn't realize that all of his effort to keep me in chains guarantees his captivity. Don't you think we might be able, after all these generations, to think about it again and do something about it? Do you think I would be standing here if I really believed that that man in the White House represented the American people? Whose country is it anyway? What happened? You can't be that afraid of Sambo. Don't you want to live? And do you think, really think, that all our money should be invested in the weapons which will only be used once, or in various space aeronautics? Isn't it possible to conceive of a world in which this effort can feed the hungry? In which this effort can make it possible for everyone to live? Is this demanding too much of a sovereign people? A civilized people? Who should know by now how kingdoms rise and fall? Who should love their children more than they do? Who should really pace the midnight hour, asking themselves, what kind of world are they leaving to those who are young now? And do you think the Bank of the Holy Ghost and Chase Manhattan Bank or the World Bank, that we have the right to allow this to happen to the human race? I wish you would think about it. This is 1984. In 16 years, it will be the year 2000. Some of us will not be here, but the young will be here. It is not too late, perhaps, to begin to overhaul the incredible morality which reached a kind of pinnacle in 1945. I am in some way luckier than the young in that I was born before the atomic age. I was born before that particular unanswerable and unforgivable obscenity. But for the young, it is altered forever. Their sense of reality, and it is altered for everyone alive and forever. The sense of the future and the sense of the past. That means it is altered one's sense of oneself. And this is the challenge. This generation, this century, and since we are in this country has to find a way to face everything we thought we believed in has got to be rethought. Everything we said was sacred, we have blasphemed. We have to take this and make it over and make it new. If we can't do it, there are others who will do it for us. But I will not be standing here if I did not have some sense of what a person, a man, a woman, can do and be. I am not a pessimist. We have a lot to do, my friends, in a very short time. I beg you to take me seriously, and I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you very much.
Novelist, playwright, and essayist James Baldwin, speaking last February at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. James Baldwin's appearance was sponsored by the Black Student Union of Lehigh University as part of their Black History Month celebration. The title of Baldwin's talk was A World I Never Made. Following Baldwin's talk, there was a question and answer session. A member of the audience asked him what generates his vision of hope.
What generates my vision of hope? Well, perhaps I want to live. But you can't deal with young people. You can't tell a child that the universe is over. Or you can't tell your wife or your lover, you know. And I've lived a very peculiar life, perhaps, a very hard life, perhaps. But I've seen some beautiful things. I've seen some beautiful people. I'm not making it up. I know what I'm talking about. You know? It may all be doomed, but that's too easy, isn't it?
The next person asked James Baldwin about his time in Turkey and how America looked from a distance.
I'll tell you something about that. I was in and out of Turkey for several years. One of the things that America looks like from Turkey, at least from the Turkish point of view, which is a very important matter, from Turkey, and not entirely wrong, it looked like the hope of the world. This is part of one of the reasons I'm standing here tonight. And many, many millions of people all over the world have thought that. It's a great betrayal of something if we betray that. Now, I know this is a very grandiose thing to say, but nevertheless, it's true. For the rest, Turkey is a part of the power. How can I put it? It's a pawn in the hands of larger powers, you know, very much like most of Africa, like the Caribbean. And many, many, many people in Turkey, very beautiful poets, very beautiful people are in the hands of a military government, partly because of the bankruptcy of the Western world.
This next question was also about Baldwin's time outside of the United States. He was asked if, while in Europe, he was treated as a black person or as just another individual.
The only way I can answer that is to tell you this. One of the many reasons I left, you've got to remember I was very young, too. One of the reasons I left, yeah, it had a lot to do with my family, it had a lot to do with trying to become a writer, but maybe more accurately, some things I realized had happened to me because I was Jimmy, because I was me. And some things had happened to me because I was black. And I had to find out the difference. I had to disentangle myself from other people's definitions. And Paris is great for me because, in fact, the French are so constructed that if you're not French, you don't exist. You know? So they left me alone. And that was what I wanted.
James Baldwin was asked to explain a statement he quoted during his talk that, quote, the will of the Republic is the will of God.
Well, I was being a little sardonic when I said the will of the Republic was the will of God. Though one of the statements Americans live by is the voice of the people, it's the voice of God. A perfectly useless statement, you know. I was trying to suggest a kind of self-righteousness created by a concept of history which is in sum, to put it very brutally now, history with a capital H, until today, is simply a hymn to white people. No one else exists in history except white people. That is why the will of the Republic is the will of God, if you see what I mean. It's a blasphemy to think of the world that way, but that is the European vision of the world. That is why Manifest Destiny came about, and that is what justified the black subjugation, justified all these crimes. As long as history is a hymn to white people, everything can be justified. That's why I'm part of the Third World, for example, if you see what I mean. What has happened is that the Western definitions of the world have crumbled. And I could put it this way. There's not one God, there are many. If there were one, what makes you think he's white? You see what I mean? I'm asking you to rethink everything, okay?
The last question was about why the civil rights movement seemed to fade from view after the 1960s.
I think part of what happened, and I don't want to sound flippant or bitter. Part of what happened had to do with the what I used to call the Northern piety. That is to say, I was born in New York, right, which is not Alabama. From the point of view of white people, especially the point of view of white liberals. And in fact, one white liberal, very famous man whose name I will not mention, asked me when I came back from my first trip south, very serious, very celebrated intellectual, asked me why didn't all the Negroes in the South move north? I didn't remind him of how many already had, or what had happened to us, or was happening to us in the North. But for a very long time, I have to call it the Northern liberal community. This is the only community which mattered in this context, really. Congratulated itself on not being Southern. I knew, and everybody involved in the movement knew, inevitably, that it would move beyond the Mason-Dixon line. It would move to Detroit, it would move to Chicago. And when it moved to Detroit, it moved to Chicago, and moved to New York, Martin Luther King would not be able to control it, and this is exactly what happened. Therefore, the Northern sympathizer, who had realized that the enemy was in the bank, where his checkbook was, moved off, and worse than that, moved off and betrayed it, he fled. And worse than that, when his kids got on the freedom train with my kids, the white kids had no way of knowing, of anticipating that their fathers and their mothers, because they were on the freedom train, would treat them worse than they treated niggers. And that is how we got the Weathermen, the Flower Children, the Seminese Liberation Army, and all those junkies and then to wind it all up. The icing on the cake was Vietnam. That's what happened. Okay? I think, ladies and gentlemen, that I will have to say thank you and good night. God bless you.